The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and probably from the Harvard Heart Letter as well. The first thing I'm going to do is a brief section called Yoga Fights Frailty. This is from the news briefs from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2023. A Harvard-led study showed that yoga fights frailty. The older we get, the more common frailty becomes. It's a loss of function, strength, stamina, and overall health and fitness that increases the risk of falls, hospitalization, and early death. But a review of 33 randomized controlled trials published online March 14, 2023, by the Annals of Internal Medicine found that yoga may offer some protection against frailty. The trials involved a total of 2,400 people aged 65 or older. Research teams from Harvard and elsewhere found that people who practice yoga improved two markers of frailty, walking speed and the ability to get up from a chair, compared with people who didn't practice yoga. Many of the studies focused on the benefits of chair-based yoga. The frequency and length of yoga sessions varied. Generally, 2 or 3 one-hour sessions per week are recommended for good health. Researchers note that yoga can be practiced at home with exercises tailored to your abilities or limitations. If you already have a regular exercise routine, like walking and strength training, consider adding yoga into the mix for the extra benefits it may provide. You can take a class at a local YMCA, senior center, or yoga studio, or try it at home. Find videos on YouTube by searching for Yoga for Older Adults, Chair Yoga, or Yoga for Seniors. Now, here's a relevant article in the Harvard Health Letter of June 2023 on vascular health. And it's entitled, Advances in Varicose Vein Treatment. Nobody wants varicose veins. They're all purple-blue, a mass of gnarled, bulging blood vessels visible in the lower legs. More than being unsightly, the veins can lead to leg swelling, tired and achy muscles, hard-to-heal ulcers that can get infected, and even disability. Fortunately, treatment for varicose veins has advanced steadily, and it's poised to take another leap forward. Varicose veins stem from problems with the superficial veins in the legs, that is, those near the surface, located about a half an inch below the skin. Like all leg veins, superficial veins have one-way valves that open as blood is pumped up toward the heart, and close to keep blood from flowing back into the legs. Over the years, the valves in a vein can become worn and stop closing properly. This causes the superficial vein to swell and puts pressure on branches of the veins, which become engorged and twisted. Those twisted branches are the ones called varicose veins. They look like a cluster of grapes under the skin, says Dr. Sherry Scovell, a vascular surgeon who specializes in venous disease at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. To get rid of varicose veins, you must first shut down the malfunctioning superficial vein. That redirects blood flow through other healthy veins. For years, the only treatment was a surgical procedure called vein stripping and ligation, that required someone to go to sleep under anesthetic so the surgeon could make an incision, tie off the problem veins, and pull them out. That caused significant bruising, discomfort, and swelling. In the 1990s, Doctors began using a much less invasive procedure called thermal ablation. It involves closing the affected vein without removing it by threading a small catheter through the vein and using heat to make the vein collapse. It's done while you're awake. You only need a local anesthetic. It works well, and we have a lot of data, and we may now have even more techniques that may be performed with minimal or no local anesthesia. The newer techniques to close superficial veins include chemical ablation, in which the doctor injects a foam solution that causes the vein's interior walls to scar and close. Adhesive closure, in which the doctor uses a catheter to deliver a natural glue that pulls vein walls together. And mechanical-chemical ablation, or MOCA, in which the doctor uses a catheter with a rotating wire to damage the vein along with a vein-scarring medication. These procedures make small varicose veins disappear. If the varicose veins are large, doctors now have tools to remove them with a tiny incision or inject a medication that causes the varicose vein to scar and close. The best treatment depends on your needs. Thermal ablation is best to treat long, straight veins. Chemical ablation is good for people with leg ulcers. MOCA is effective in areas where there's a nerve close to the vein. But they all require you to take it easy after treatment, and you'll need to wear a compression stocking for a little while. With glue, you just walk out of the office and get right back to your life. It's best for someone who can't take time off. But some people have a reaction to the glue, so there are pros and cons to each option. In a few years, we may have another option to treat varicose veins. The technology called high-intensity focused ultrasound, or HIFU, converts sound waves into a focused beam of heat that seals the vein. The treatment is done from the outside of the leg, almost like zapping the varicose veins away. HIFU is already approved in the United States to treat certain cancers, uterine fibroids, Parkinson's disease tremors, thyroid nodules, and more. And other countries have been using HIFU to treat varicose veins for years. We have excellent evidence for its use in the United Kingdom, and results of the first clinical trial here were promising, Dr. Scovell says. If it's eventually approved, it will be a game changer. But don't wait if you need treatment. We already have minimally invasive procedures to help you right now. Now, here's a very relevant article for the summer from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2023. And it's called The Best Sun Protective Clothing. Suit up in densely woven fabrics and a hat to stay safe from ultraviolet rays. Summer officially starts in June, and in addition to using a strong sunscreen when you go outside, it's a good idea to wear sun protective clothing. That's not just any hat or long sleeve shirt in your closet. Sun-protected clothes are made of materials that effectively shield your skin from harmful UV rays. First, there are protective fabrics. Loosely woven fabrics of summer, like gauze and linen, do very little to keep UV radiation from reaching your skin. The best defense comes from tightly woven fabrics with high thread counts in dark or bright colors. Examples include polyester, nylon, lightweight wool, or canvas. Many clothing manufacturers now use high-tech fabrics for sun-protective garments. High-tech fabrics offer at least as much protection as regular densely woven fabrics, and maybe more. Often these fabrics wick away moisture and dry quickly. Some are even embedded with chemicals used in sunscreens. Note, however, that such chemical protection may last for only a limited amount of wash cycles, like 20 or possibly 40. UPF protection. You'll know for sure if clothes are sun protective if they have ultraviolet protection factor rating on the label. That's a measure of how much UV radiation penetrates the fabric. Look for a UPF rating of 50, which should block about 98% of the sun's rays. It's comparable to sunscreen with a sun protection factor of 30, so wearing the clothes is consistent with putting sunscreen on. Dr. Abigail Waldman, director of the Mohs and Dermatologic Surgery Center at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital, says, can you skip sunscreen if you're wearing UPF-rated clothes? Yes, but only for areas covered by the clothes. Any exposed skin still needs sunscreen, like your neck, your ears, your hands, and your feet. And keep in mind that all clothes, UPF-rated or not, provide less UV protection when they get wet or if they're stretched and light can peek between the fibers. So make sure clothing fits loosely. And it's not a bad idea to wear a waterproof sunscreen beneath sun-protective clothes if you know you'll be perspiring a lot or going into water, Dr. Waldman says. If you're looking to buy UPF-rated clothing, you'll find a wide range of options to shield every inch of your skin, including hats, scarves, gloves, face masks, neck gaiters, shirts, hoodies, dresses, skirts, shorts, pants, leggings, shawls, swimwear, unitards, and more. Which item do you really need? The more skin you cover, the better, especially if you're doing yard work or going to the beach, Dr. Waldman says. A hat, long sleeve shirt, and pants are preferable. That could be a challenge on a really hot day, so make sure the fabric feels breathable and has moisture-wicking properties. UPF-rated clothing can be pricey. A man's long sleeve tee from some of the larger retailers, like Coolabah Sun Protective Clothing, Columbia Sportswear, Lands' End, or L.L. Bean, goes for about $50. Brimmed hats also start at about $50. To save money, Dr. Waldman recommends using a laundry aid that adds sun protective chemicals to densely woven clothes you already own, like dry fit nylon or polyester blend tees. The laundry aid is called RIT Sun Guard, and it can give clothes a UPF of 30. It's a powder. You just throw it in with normal washing, and it lasts for 20 washes. The clothes look the same, Dr. Waldman says. A word about hats. You need a hat that protects more than just the crown of the head from UV rays. That means you need a wide brim. A lot of people fall short by using a baseball cap, but it doesn't cover the ears, the chin, or the back of the neck. So get as wide a brim as possible, at least 3 inches. If you're not wearing a hat with a wide brim, apply sunscreen on exposed areas. And that goes for when you wear bike helmets, too. They have slits that allow for sunburns. A hat's material and construction also are important considerations. You don't want a lot of mesh or large holes in the hat because UV rays can reach your skin. The best material would be canvas, polyester, or nylon. They'll provide more protection than a straw hat, Dr. Waldman says. Taking the time to wear protective clothing has a big payoff. Even one sunburn can result in skin cancer in a few years. If you can cover up and avoid burning now, you'll be better off later. Now I'm going to turn to the Harvard Heart Letter. This is also a June 2023 issue. And the first article is called All About Your Heart Rate. Here's what you should know about target and maximum heart rates during exercise and other things that can speed up or slow down your heart. If you're committed to keeping your heart in good shape, perhaps you already know how much heart-pumping aerobic exercise you should be getting each week. You should be getting 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise, or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise, or an equivalent combination. But just how high should your heart rate rise during exercise? Should you aim for a specific target? Is it dangerous to go above your maximum heart rate? For answers and related questions, we asked Dr. Sawala Gusa, Director of the Cardiovascular Performance Program at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. The term maximum or peak heart rate refers to the upper limit of what your cardiovascular system can handle during physical activity measured in beats per minute. Accurately determining this number requires a cardiopulmonary exercise test, which tracks how your lungs, heart, blood vessels, and muscles react during an exercise challenge. It's more practical to estimate your maximum heart rate. The usual formula is 220 minus your age. But this just gives you a ballpark figure. We know the ability to raise your heart rate tends to decrease with age, but using age alone really isn't the best metric for determining your maximum heart rate, says Dr. Gusa. Created in the early 1970s, the formula was based on testing done on men and tends to overestimate peak heart rates in women, and estimates for all individuals may be off by as much as 15 beats per minute. Target heart rates are expressed as a percentage of your maximum heart rate. For example, if you're 65, your estimated maximum heart rate is 220 minus 65, or 155 beats per minute. For moderate intensity exercise, your target heart rate is 64% to 76% of that. In other words, 99 to 118 beats per minute. For vigorous intensity exercise, your target range is 119 to 144 beats per minute. Of course, popular wrist-worn devices can do these calculations for you, but these gadgets have limitations and aren't really necessary. Remember that heart rate targets are simply guides, and there's no medical evidence that healthy people need to exercise at specific heart rates. But knowing the range that's considered moderate or vigorous for you can help you determine whether you're meeting the recommended exercise goal and can be used to guide training to enhance your fitness or performance, says Dr. Gusa. Another option is simply to use the talk test. If you're breathing faster than usual but can still carry on conversation, you're exercising at moderate intensity. If you have trouble finishing a sentence, you're doing vigorous intensity exercise. If you're new to exercise, start slowly and build up to a more vigorous exercise gradually. If you're already an avid exerciser, it's usually not a problem to reach or even exceed your maximum heart rate for short periods of time. People who have or are at risk for heart disease should be more cautious and check with their clinician about how to exercise safely. What else affects heart rate? A normal resting heart rate is between 60 and 100. The best time to check yours is first thing in the morning, before you even get out of bed. Other than exercise, factors that can elevate your heart rate include hot weather, dehydration, being at a high altitude, or feeling nervous or excited. Certain drugs like stimulants and some medical conditions like anemia, asthma, infection, and fevers can also cause your heart rate to rise. Your heart rate will dip during sleep, sometimes dropping as low as 40 to 50 beats per minute, especially if your resting heart rate is on the low end. Medical problems that may lower your heart rate include heart disease, low thyroid function, and high blood levels of potassium. Beta blockers, a class of medication used to treat high blood pressure, and other heart conditions also slow down the heart. Examples include metoprolol, which is also called lopressor or toprol, and carvedilol or Coreg. Highly trained athletes often have low resting heart rates, sometimes in the 40s or even 30s, says Dr. Gusa. After years of training, their heart undergoes what's known as exercise-induced cardiac remodeling. Because their hearts are bigger, each beat pumps more blood, so the heart doesn't have to beat as often to supply the body with blood, he says. Most smartwatches and wearable fitness trackers use your age to estimate your target heart rate. These devices periodically measure your heartbeat through the day using optical sensors that detect light bouncing back from the blood flowing beneath the skin of your inner wrist. For some people, working hard to achieve their target heart rate motivates them to exercise more and further boosts their fitness levels, says Harvard cardiologist Dr. Gusa. But if you're worried about your heart rate for whatever reason, checking the number too often might make you even more anxious, he says. In addition, some studies suggest that the heart rate estimates from wrist-worn devices may be less accurate in people with darker skin compared with people whose skin is lighter. If you have one of these devices, you can check its accuracy by taking your pulse manually, ideally at rest and during activities of different levels of intensity. Press your index and middle fingers together on your wrist, just below the base of your thumb. Count the number of beats in 15 seconds and multiply by 4 to get beats per minute. Now we're going to turn to Ask the Doctor by Dr. Christopher Cadden. And the first is a discussion of a device to prevent strokes in atrial fibrillation. Question: I have occasional atrial fibrillation and take anti-clotting medication. My doctor suggested that I consider getting a Watchman device. What is that, and are there any drawbacks? The Watchman device is a tiny basket-like device that's implanted inside the heart. It's designed to help prevent clots from traveling from the heart to the brain, where they might block a blood vessel and cause a stroke. Blood clots tend to form during bouts of atrial fibrillation because the heart's upper chambers quiver instead of beating normally. As a result, blood tends to stagnate and form clots, most of which form in a tiny pouch that hangs off the upper left side of the heart, called the left atrial appendage. Some people take warfarin to prevent blood clots, but most take direct oral anticoagulants like apixaban or Eliquis or rivaroxaban or Xarelto. While these medications all help lower stroke risk, they increase the risk of bleeding, which is usually minor, but sometimes can be serious. The Watchman device can be a good alternative for people with atrial fib who have already experienced serious bleeding in the brain, gastrointestinal tract, or elsewhere, says Dr. Jeremy Ruskin, founder of the Arrhythmia Service at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Older people who face a high risk for bleeding or experiencing a fall may also be good candidates for the device, as are those who cannot tolerate anti-clotting medication. After receiving a Watchman device, people need to take anti-clotting drugs for about 6 weeks until a layer of cells grows over the device. After that, they can stop the medication. As with any medical procedure, there are risks associated with implanting the device. The Watchman is like a tiny inverted umbrella, and the small prongs that grip the opening of the left atrial appendage as the device expands can perforate the heart. As a result, fluid can accumulate around the heart. This problem, known as pericardial effusion, occurs in only about 1% of cases, although the risk of any major complication is 4%. For unknown reasons, women are more likely than men to have complications. The FDA maintains that for women who are appropriate candidates, the benefits of a Watchman still outweighs the risks. The risk of dangerous bleeding is almost completely eliminated, and for people with atrial fib and a history of brain bleeds on anti-clotting drugs, the Watchman can be a godsend, Dr. Ruskin says. Ask your cardiologist whether he thinks or she thinks you would be a candidate, and to explain whether your age and any other health conditions you have could affect your decision, he advises. So note that the Watchman is really only intended for people who have a history of serious bleeding while on anticoagulant drugs. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.